KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump fired both Democrats on the Federal Trade Commission. We talked to one of them, Alvaro Bedoya, who is fighting what he calls the president's attempt to turn the agency into a lapdog. It's coming up on Morning Edition from NPR News. When measles break out around the world, there's a network of labs designed to help the fight. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. The Trump administration pulled funding to those labs, so who takes up the measles fight? Also, we visit South Texas, where immigrant detention centers help drive the local economy, and how the Red Scare's hunt for communists is still relevant today. It's Thursday, March 20th, which means it's time to do the right thing and wish Spike Lee a happy 68th birthday. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Gaza's health ministry says more than 500 people have been killed in Israeli airstrikes since Israel broke a ceasefire deal with Hamas on Tuesday. The health ministry says more than 200 of the dead are children. This comes as Israeli ground troops expanded the war by re-entering part of northern Gaza. NPR's Anas Baba visited a hospital in the north and has this report.
Israel's military says it struck Hamas infrastructure and weapons site in the area of Beit Lahia in northern Gaza. Families there say it was their homes and their children asleep in the night that were struck by Israeli warplanes without warning. The floors of the Indonesian hospital in Beit Lahia are covered in blood and bodies wrapped in shrouds. The hospital morgue says 75 people died here overnight and into the morning from the airstrikes, including entire families. We were just sitting at home. Oh Allah, we only have you, says Yusuf Abu Halima. He says Israeli airstrikes just hit before dawn, killing his brother, sister, and other relatives. Anas Baba, NPR News, Gaza City.
President Trump is expected to sign an executive action today calling for the dismantling of the U.S. Department of Education. NPR's Corey Turner reports this has been foreseen since February, when the White House revealed its intentions.
The anticipated signing comes a week after sweeping layoffs at the Education Department. Between early retirement, buyouts, the firing of newer hires, and last week's big reduction in force, the department will soon be down to roughly half the size it was when Trump took office. The White House insisted in a fact sheet to NPR that the executive action would not cut key federal funding streams that help schools serve low-income students, kids with disabilities, and rural communities. But last week's purge included the entire legal staff at the department responsible for making sure that funding is spent according to law and reaches the children who need it most. Corey Turner, NPR News.
A freeze on government-issued payment cards is threatening water safety testing and other projects at the U.S. Interior Department. NPR Shannon Bond reports employees warn this is affecting their work.
Government pay card spending has been capped at a dollar to comply with an executive order signed by President Trump last month. That affects millions of cards federal employees use in their work every day. A federal maintenance worker in the southern U.S. can't make payments for water safety testing. Employees at the U.S. Geological Survey can't buy equipment to repair stream gauges that monitor water flow. They have to rely on the single person in each region authorized to make payments. The spending freeze comes as Interior employees are bracing for job cuts of up to 40%. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
On Wall Street, stocks are significantly higher. The Dow is up more than 230 points. The Nasdaq is up almost 90 points. This is NPR. A jury in North Dakota has determined environmental group Greenpeace must pay hundreds of millions of dollars in a lawsuit. It'll go to a company that built the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline. The company says Greenpeace led protests against the pipeline that cost the company money and damaged its reputation. The federal D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals has rejected a computer scientist's bid to copyright a piece of art. It was made by artificial intelligence. NPR's Bobby Allen reports the plaintiff plans to appeal to the Supreme Court.
The federal appeals court wrote, "This case presents a question made salient by recent advances in artificial intelligence. Can a non-human machine be an author under the Copyright Act of 1976? Its answer, no. And that's because the 49-year-old law says only a work made by a human can be copyrighted. The Missouri computer scientist Stephen Thayer says he guided his AI to create an image called A Recent Entrance to Paradise, and the AI deserves to own it. The Copyright Office has granted copyright to work assisted by AI, but Thayer says the AI itself should be an author. The federal appeals court rejected this. Thayer says he is appealing. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Food and beverage corporation Nestle USA is recalling some of its frozen meals. They're made by Stouffer's and Lean Cuisine. The company says that a few batches could be contaminated by what it calls wood-like material. There has been a report that one person had a potential choking incident. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And Amy Martinez in Culver City, California. Coming up, we'll speak with one of two Democratic commissioners the Trump administration fired from the Federal Trade Commission yesterday. But first, Israel has launched a new ground invasion into Gaza.
That's expanding what it says is a new offensive in the enclave after it broke the nearly two-month-long ceasefire with Hamas. On Tuesday, there were a series of airstrikes that killed more than 400 Palestinians and wounded hundreds more.
We're joined now by NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv. Kat, so what can you tell us about the ground invasion and what's happening?
So Israel is calling this a, quote, targeted ground operation into central and southern Gaza. But we've heard that language from the Israeli military before. It was used a lot in Gaza before the ceasefire, and that invasion caused widespread devastation and destruction and killed more than 49,000 Palestinians, according to health officials there. The Israeli military said its aim with this ground invasion is to expand what it calls the, quote, security perimeter that separates Gaza from southern Israel. Israel has also sent troops back into areas that they had retreated from during the ceasefire, like the Netzarim Corridor. That's a large strip of land that divides Gaza's north and south. Early on in the war, Israel created that corridor and then closed passage for Palestinians between the north and south for more than a year. Just this morning, it partially closed passage again.
Now, what have you been hearing from Palestinians living in Gaza and the situation around them?
Yeah, I mean, people are worried and scared. Many had just started trying to pick up what they could of their lives during that 8 weeks of relative calm. And they're now shocked to be back in the war with airstrikes and evacuation orders again. You know, it's important to remember that Israel has been blocking all aid, including electricity, into Gaza for more than 2 weeks now, trying to pressure Hamas into accepting a new ceasefire deal on different terms than were agreed to back in January. And there are still ongoing Israeli airstrikes. At least 70 people were killed yesterday, according to Gaza Civil Defense, and more were reported overnight. Our producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, spoke to one woman in Gaza City. She's a grandma named Saif Al-Hurra. She says her son and his whole family were killed earlier in the war, and now the building she was staying in with three of her grandchildren was damaged in these strikes. You can hear the pain and anger in her voice there. She said, this is a calamity. We can't take it anymore.
What are Israeli government officials saying?
Israel Defense Minister Israel Katz put out a video statement yesterday addressing it to Gaza residents. He spoke in Hebrew with Arabic subtitles, and he told them that this is their, quote, final warning, saying that all the hostages must be released and Hamas must be removed from power. He said, what comes next will be much harsher, and you will bear the full consequences. He went on to say that Israel will act, quote, with force beyond anything you have ever seen.
Okay, and how did Hamas respond?
Earlier today here in Tel Aviv, sirens sounded around the city, and then several loud explosions shook the air. Hamas later took responsibility, saying it fired rockets toward the city in response to Israel's airstrikes in Gaza. It's the first time the militant group has done that, fired rockets toward Tel Aviv, since October of last year. The Israeli military said it intercepted one rocket and two others fell in, quote, open spaces. No casualties were reported.
All right, that's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv. Kat, thank you very much for your reporting on this.
Thanks so much.
The Trump administration fired two Democratic commissioners on the Federal Trade Commission yesterday. Now both say they plan to sue. The FTC is an independent government agency responsible for policing corporate America and enforcing consumer protection laws. Antitrust groups are alarmed over the firing, saying not only are they illegal, they're a gift to the president's wealthiest supporters. Here's how White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt explained the move to reporters.
Because the time was right to let these people go, and the president absolutely has the authority to do it.
I'm joined now in studio by one of the Democratic commissioners who was fired, Alvaro Bedoya. Good morning, and thank you for being on the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We heard the White House press secretary there say the president has absolutely the authority to do what he did to you. What do you say to that?
What's really interesting about that is the press secretary gives no reason whatsoever for why we're fired, no cause. Mm-hmm. And yet the Supreme Court has said, in a case that remains good law today, we can only be removed for neglect, malfeasance, or inefficiency. This is a naked power grab on behalf of the president, and it's going to open the door, as you indicated, for corruption and corporate giveaways, I think, for his top donors.
How are you told you were fired, and were you given a reason?
It was just after work. I'd arrived at my daughter's gymnastics class, and I got a call from my colleague, Commissioner Slaughter, telling me to check my email that she'd just been fired, or allegedly fired. And I opened up my email, and sure enough, there was an email from the president's staff claiming to fire me. No reason given whatsoever.
No reason given whatsoever. And just to let the listeners know, you were nominated under former President Biden. Your colleague, Rebecca Slaughter, was nominated under Trump's first administration.
That's right.
Both of you terminated before your terms were upped. Now, the FTC historically has five members, right?
Yes.
No more than three from the same political party. Mm. Mark Meador, who was Trump's pick to fill the third Republican spot, has not yet been confirmed by the Senate. Can the commission function with just two members, both from the same party, as the president?
It absolutely can. And I think that's what folks are missing here, because any one of the cases we have right now, we're suing the largest provider of multifamily rental units in the country for packing their rent bills with hidden junk fees. Mm-hmm. We are trying to ban subscription traps that keep people from being able to unsubscribe from something unless they call like every other Tuesday between 10 a.m. and noon. We're suing John Deere for screwing over ranchers and farmers, preventing them from fixing their tractors, making them take it to the dealership. Any one of those cases, any one of those rules can be withdrawn by the current commissioners who the president says are on the commission, although I would say I'm still there myself.
Now, you've said billionaires and Trump associates will benefit. Specifically, who could benefit, how and why, with just two people from the same party on this commission?
Think about the billionaires who are over President Trump's shoulder at the inauguration. Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos. I am currently suing or enforcing court orders against each of their companies. Amazon, for example, we're suing for ripping off small business sellers on their site such that the company pockets up to 50 cents of every dollar they make on that site and makes it nearly impossible for them to offer consumers lower prices off the site. I'm also sitting as a judge in a matter where staff is alleging that pharmacy middlemen are jacking up the price of insulin illegally. Any one of these actions could be withdrawn by the folks who the president says are currently at the commission. And here's the thing, even if they oppose that, it doesn't matter. In a world where the president can fire anyone at any time, if they can, they have a choice. They can either obey, or if they say no, what will happen to them is what has just happened to me.
Now, Trump allies generally, some people who may be listening to you right now will say the president has the right to put his own people in place and get rid of those he doesn't want. What do you say to those Americans?
I say that this is about corruption and corporate pardons. Again, let's go back to Amazon. We're already seeing this kind of conduct happen. One of the last public statements I made about Amazon was calling out how they treated their warehouse workers on the factory floor. These folks work so fast, so hard, that their hands stop working, their shoulders tear, their backs bulge and break. And yet, Amazon has donated $1 million, cut a deal with the First Lady that'll flow, according to the New York Post, $28 million into her pockets. And now the person nominated to lead the Occupational Safety and Health Administration is a former Amazon executive. There is every reason to think that these billionaires are going to use their power to shut down the lawsuits they don't like, that hurt small business sellers, that hurt people who are struggling to pay for their medicine. So this is not about a unitary executive. This is about corporate pardons and corruption for these folks who have sent hundreds of millions of dollars into the president's pockets.
And really quickly, I mean, you talked about your concern that these firings will set a precedent that anybody can be fired at any time. Are you optimistic that you'll be reinstated if you sue?
I am optimistic, and people need to understand, if I can be removed for any reason at any time, so can Jerome Powell at the Fed. And so it's not just about small businesses and consumers, it's also about retirees and investors and their life savings in the stock market.
That was Alvaro Bedoya, who was fired from his role as an FTC commissioner this week. NPR invited FTC Chair Andrew Ferguson to join us on tomorrow's show. An agency spokesperson declined on his behalf.
After a phone call with President Trump yesterday, the leaders of Russia and Ukraine have agreed to stop striking each other's energy infrastructure as part of a limited ceasefire deal. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is pushing for a total ceasefire that would include civilian infrastructure. So far, the Kremlin has not agreed. Here's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley.
Hello, Taras. I meet Taras Yatsenko in his upscale neighborhood in the western Ukrainian city of Lviv.
So I live like a few blocks from here.
Last September, he was asleep in his house with his wife and three daughters when the air raid sirens began to wail. They heard swarms of drones overhead and knew missiles were on their way because of an app Ukrainians have on their phones.
My kids started crying, shouting, and they said, "Oh, Daddy, let's go to the basement." You know, you had a very short time to make it your decision. Should you go down to the basement or should you still stay here? Because, you know, missile, it takes just seconds. So I said, no, we stay here.
Seconds later, a hypersonic Kinzhal missile shook their house, but they were fine. A few blocks over, the Basilevich family wasn't so lucky. 43-year-old Yevhenia and her three daughters were killed in their stairwell while running to their basement. Today, there are pictures and a shrine with candles and teddy bears outside their damaged, boarded-up house. President Zelensky is seeking a broader ceasefire to include residential areas like this one, as well as ports and railways. He spoke to the media last night. We had 107 Shahed drones in the skies tonight, said Zelensky, and I'm afraid that will continue until we get an agreement, hopefully a broader one. Zelensky said he felt Trump had really listened to him on last night's phone call. The U.S., Ukraine, and Russian officials are expected to meet in the coming days in Saudi Arabia to figure out how to implement the partial ceasefire deal, though it's unclear when it would take effect. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the New Yorker staff writer Andrew Marantz joins us to discuss how podcasts, streams, and YouTube channels have become the platforms where men who feel disillusioned and alienated go to feel seen and heard, with many of them gravitating toward the MAGA movement. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/iulab. From Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez.
And I'm Layla Faldin. A new book by journalist Clay Risen brings back to life a period of American history after World War II known as the Red Scare. According to Risen, what should have been a counterintelligence effort ended up as
the whole cultural witch hunt against all kinds of people who, regardless of their pasts, did not deserve to be hounded out of their professions and out of their livelihoods.
The book is Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. And it's based in part on newly declassified sources. Risen spoke with our co-host, Steve Inskeep.
It would be easy to think of the McCarthy era as a relic or a part of the Cold War, but you say it's part of a culture war. What do you mean by a culture war?
What I mean, Steve, is that, you know, beginning in the 1930s, there was a real cultural change in America. It was brought about by the experience of the Depression, but also the government activism on the part of the Roosevelt administration, what we know as the New Deal. And obviously, we know the New Deal had a lot of impact in terms of building new institutions, but it also helped foster a cultural change in America, a progressive change, a more cosmopolitan, more pluralistic change. And from the very beginning, there was a lot of opposition to that, even though it was ascendant. There were a lot of people who didn't like it and a lot of people who took a very conspiratorial view toward that.
You acknowledge early on there really were communist spies. There were Soviet spies in America. So there was an actual threat, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The Soviet government really was trying to infiltrate elements of American society, either through the Communist Party or through spies in the government. But it's also important to recognize two things. First, that it was a pretty small effort. The Communist Party was small. These spies were not very effective. But also, most of this, almost all of it, in fact, was ended by the end of World War II. So by the time the Red Scare started, we were talking about ghosts of the past. And yet, the people we were going after were in the present.
What was the motivation of people like Senator Joseph McCarthy, whose name was given to the era, and others who were extreme anti-communists?
Well, I think it's a mix of both real ideological fervor and I would say legitimate concern about the state of the country, but also a lot of opportunism. And, you know, you look at someone like McCarthy, and I do think on some level McCarthy really believed that there was this conspiracy at the heart of the American government. And he really believed that communism was this threat. But he also was no doubt an opportunist. And he saw this as an opportunity to elevate his position in the Senate, in American politics. And of course, that's what he did. And you can look at a lot of other people around him, both who preceded him during the Red Scare and also who saw him as someone they could sort of rise with. And it's hard not to read that as opportunism and rank partisanship.
As I read your account of this, I think about the power of narratives. If people have bought into, if they believe the narrative that there is a vast, vast communist conspiracy to take over America, any evidence you find can be judged in light of that narrative. And if you don't find any evidence, it just shows the conspiracy is even bigger than you thought.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is a part of the story that I think Americans today will connect with, is this all-consuming power of the conspiracy theory. And of course, again, this is all in the context of the Cold War, which is a new thing, and it was a nuclear thing, and was really scary for a lot of people. And so as soon as someone came along and said, we have to be absolutely sure, regardless of whose rights we violate, that we are safe as a country, and there's a conspiracy, by the way, that we have to check against, well, really, Katie bar the door, there's no stopping those people.
In your judgment, Clay, how well did the Constitution hold up?
You know, it's like a lot of things in America. It did not do very well until it did. And one of the things I think is really important to note about the Red Scare is that for a long time, the people who should have stood up did not stand up. They were afraid, or maybe they were complicit in some way. But eventually people did. And these were lawyers, and they were some politicians. They were journalists like Edward R. Murrow. One person that I really highlight is Chief Justice Earl Warren, who no one expected to be a strong civil libertarian. But when he came into office onto the bench, rather unexpectedly, he began to develop a philosophy around civil liberties. And he saw the Red Scare as what it was, a fundamental threat to American civil liberties. And over the course of 4 years, even as he's going after school desegregation, he was also developing a list of cases that would allow him to start to dismantle the tools of the Red Scare and using the power of the court to uphold constitutional values and ultimately to validate them and to push back the Red Scare. So I think there were moments of real constitutional crisis in America, but ultimately it was people like Earl Warren who stood up and took the best of the Constitution and pushed things back.
In the long run, and it was a period of years, of course, and many lives were ruined, did Americans at large end up being more secure in their civil liberties then?
I think, yes. I think that one of the silver linings of the Red Scare is that it reminded a lot of people that civil liberties cannot be taken for granted, that they need to be defended.
How did the Red Scare end?
The Red Scare ended partly because the world moved on. Communism was clearly not a threat to the United States. People came to realize that. Also, the Cold War simmered down. But I think also it ended because of the actions of people who stood up against this. And you were talking about journalists like Edward R. Murrow, who exposed McCarthy on television. We're talking about people like Chief Justice Earl Warren, who very systematically worked his way through the legal architecture of the Red Scare and either pulled it back or dismantled it completely. And that's ultimately what brought the Red Scare to an end.
Clay Risen's latest book is Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. Pleasure talking with you again.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Steve.
This is NPR News.
A Veterans Affairs home loan program has so far saved thousands of vets from foreclosure. They needed saving because of the VA's own mistake. But now an effort in Congress could kill the program.
Getting rid of something that would keep me and my family in a home is just intentionally cruel.
I'm Elsa Chang. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S. Institute of Peace has lost its latest legal bid to block what essentially is a hostile takeover by the Trump administration. The U.S. IP is trying to keep from being dismantled and filed suit on the grounds the administration does not have the authority to control a congressionally created nonprofit think tank. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports on what led to the federal judge's decision against USIP.
U.S. District Judge Beryl Howell said that there was confusion in this complaint itself, in the lawsuit. She also pointed out that a temporary restraining order, which is the specific ask that was being made yesterday, is really an extraordinary step. There are certain thresholds, legal thresholds, that have to be met for a court to agree to take that step. And what Howell said was that a couple of those thresholds just weren't met, including the likelihood of this lawsuit to succeed on the merits.
U.S. stocks trading higher this hour, a day after the Fed announced it would keep its key interest rate where it is, but signaled it's still on track to cut interest rates at least twice this year. Economists are waiting to see how the economy fares in the wake of government-wide layoffs and tariffs. NPR's Marie Aspen has more.
The Fed isn't taking any major action yet, but it did say yesterday it's now expecting the economy to grow more slowly this year than it previously projected, and inflation to grow faster.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 153 points at 42,117. This is NPR News. Many Ukrainians are anxiously waiting to see if President Trump's separate talks this week with the leaders of Russia and Ukraine lead to a lasting peace deal after more than 3 years of war. Vladimir Putin and Volodymyr Zelensky have each agreed to a partial ceasefire involving energy. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley spoke to a resident in Kyiv.
At a Kyiv grocery store, 27-year-old Bella, who didn't want to give her last name for fear of retaliation, says Trump seems to be pursuing a deal in favor of Putin.
Which is making me insecure about what's coming, but at the same time, I don't know, I have to accept what's going on and contribute to what I can.
She says drones, possibly those supplied by Iran, kept her up last night.
So I've been hearing explosions, and I've been hearing how the Shaheds are flying here.
Zelensky says he is committed to not striking Russian oil depots and energy infrastructure for 30 days, but he says Ukraine wants a ban on striking civilian infrastructure, which Putin has not yet agreed to. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
It's officially spring. Today's arrival of the vernal equinox marks a season of longer days and warmer temperatures in the northern hemisphere, while the southern hemisphere marks the first day of autumn. The planet's axis and its orbit line up, hitting both hemispheres with an equal amount of sunlight. People around the globe celebrating the moment. It's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Mae Martinez in Culver City, California. Detention centers in Texas hold more migrants than those in any other state. Now, earlier this month, it was about 11,000 people, and that includes some children who are in the same facility as their parents. Texas Newsroom investigative reporter Stella Chavez spent some time talking to the neighbors of two detention centers in South Texas.
Dilley, Texas is the kind of small town where people know each other. The post office displays a sign that reads Dilley, a slice of the good life. Reynaldo Trevino was born here and thinks the Trump administration and Texas Governor Greg Abbott spend too much money on immigration enforcement. But good-paying jobs are scarce, so plans to reopen the South Texas Family Residential Center means more jobs. Some pay as much as $30 an hour. Trevino thinks many will try to land a job at the privately run facility.
It's like any other job. It's just like a prison, right? You're hired and you're doing a job, and why not? And I don't see anything wrong with that individual working there if he has an economic decision to make.
Although border crossings have dropped recently, Texas continues to be a major player in Trump's mass deportation plans. About 20 detention facilities are in the state. A few months ago, the state land commissioner offered the Trump administration property along the border to hold migrants. CoreCivic has operated the Dilley facility since 2014, but last summer, the Biden administration decided to close it. Henry Arredondo, the city administrator, says the city lost 500 to 600 jobs.
We feel the effects, like a direct impact.
Arredondo says he used to visit the center, which can hold 2,400 people. He describes it as clean and organized. He's glad jobs are returning, but also feels sympathy for the families who will be housed there.
The human beings that are going to be there, they're on a challenging adventure, you want to call it. But, you know, they need to be treated with dignity and respect.
Residents here say they don't focus too much on controversies about immigration. More than 60% voted for Trump in 2024. 100 miles east, families are already being held at the Karnes County Center, according to attorneys who've visited the 1,300-bed facility. Recently, the GEO Group updated its contract with the federal government so that it can hold families instead of only adult males. It's unclear how many families are there. Both CoreCivic and the GEO Group referred questions to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. ICE did not return emails or phone calls seeking comment. Laura Flores-Dixit, an attorney with the nonprofit American Gateways, represents one of the families at the Karnes Center.
We're immensely concerned about children being detained at any time. It's our fervent belief that there's no humane way to detain children.
Karnes County Judge Wade Hedke says the GEO Group has been a great partner for the past 20 plus years.
They brought good paying jobs. They've employed a lot of our locals. But as far as what goes on behind those walls, the county doesn't have anything to do with it.
Nearly 4 in 5 people here voted for Trump in 2024. At Becky's Cafe downtown, Mike Guerrero enjoys his lunch. He says in this part of Texas, everyone knows someone who immigrated, legally or illegally. As for Trump's plan to deport migrants, his concern is the children.
I don't agree in separating the kids if they can avoid that. That'd be a good idea to house the whole families in those until they decide, you know, what they're going to do with them.
Less than a mile away is the Karnes facility, a sprawling building with security cameras and fencing all around. It's where migrants will continue to arrive. For NPR News, I'm Stella Chavez in South Texas.
Measles cases are still rising in the U.S. and in other parts of the world. The Trump administration ended funding to a global network of labs that test for the disease. NPR's Gabriela Emanuel looked into what could happen next.
In much of the world, when a doctor sees a patient with a fever and rash and suspects measles, they send a blood sample off to a specialized lab to get tested. Kate O'Brien is with the World Health Organization.
And that laboratory network, which is over 700 labs around the world, has been fully supported through the generosity and the technical support of the U.S. government.
Funded by the U.S., but run by the WHO. In January, the U.S. decided to withdraw from the WHO and pulled the funding, including for this network of labs.
And so this lab network is now under severe threat of collapse, and it would mean many, many more outbreaks, many, many more deaths, and many, many more cases.
A spokesperson for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said funding to support domestic measles labs continues.
But not detecting and controlling cases in other countries is a problem for the U.S., says William Moss of Johns Hopkins University. He says the measles virus does not circulate naturally in America anymore. These days,
all measles outbreaks in the United States are starting with importations from outside.
The virus arrives through travelers. For example, a measles case in Maryland earlier this month was in someone who had just returned from an international trip. The White House did not respond to requests for comment, nor did the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Tom Frieden is a former CDC director. He says if the Trump administration decides it does not want to fund global disease control, then it should have a transition plan.
When you stop things suddenly, bad things happen. This network is a backbone of health defense. If it collapses, the U.S. and the rest of the world will be flying blind.
The WHO says it's looking for other sources of funding for the labs. The price tag? $8 million a year. Jennifer Nuzzo says that's a great financial deal, since quickly detecting a case is much cheaper than fighting an outbreak. Measles is one of the most contagious diseases, so she says outbreaks can get out of control quickly. Nuzzo directs the Pandemic Center at Brown University.
The amount of resources it requires to control measles outbreaks is extraordinary.
Like emergency vaccination campaigns. They're very costly, she says, as are hospitalizations for measles patients. She says, think of a measles outbreak as a fire. Like right now, there's a fire raging in Texas, in New Mexico, in Congo, and elsewhere. And that global laboratory network.
You can think of it like the smoke detectors that tell us where the fires are so that we know how to respond to it.
She says it's like the U.S. has decided to unplug smoke detectors all over the world. Gabriella Emanuel, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And doctors, there's still uncertainty on the best medical care for transgender kids. Some European countries are pulling back on hormones and puberty blockers. Next time, here and now.
With everything from groceries to orthodontics, yes, really, available on demand, why not public radio? Make playing NPR or this station part of your smart speaker routine to stay informed on your schedule.
Good morning, I'm Leila Falden. The Coast Guard of New Zealand rushed into action this week after they got a report of two swimmers that needed help. They sent a boat and a helicopter. Four police officers looked from land, too. But after almost an hour, the search came up empty. It was only later they found out the struggling swimmers were geese. The Coast Guard said they still appreciated the call. Better safe than sorry. Talk about a wild goose chase. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldig.
And I'm A. Martinez. A federal jury in Minneapolis has convicted two people in what federal prosecutors say was the nation's largest COVID fraud scheme. The founder and executive director of a Minnesota nonprofit called Feeding Our Future was found guilty of organizing a plan to rip off publicly funded child nutrition programs for almost $250 million. Jurors also said a former restaurant owner played a major role in that conspiracy. Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio has been covering this. So, Matt, how do prosecutors say that this scheme got started?
Well, it involved two programs that the U.S. Department of Agriculture has operated since the late 1960s to provide food to kids from low-income families enrolled in after-school and summer activities. When COVID forced kids to stay home, the USDA allowed restaurants to participate in the food programs. Investigators say this and other rule changes, combined with lax government oversight, gave the conspirators an opportunity to get rich. Feeding Our Future founder Amy Bach and former restaurant owner Salim Saeed are among 70 defendants charged in the case. Prosecutors say the group set up hundreds of fake meal distribution sites. They used these to submit phony reimbursement claims replete with falsified invoices and attendance rosters listing fictitious children. Over 18 months, the group claimed to have served 92 million meals and collected nearly $250 million.
And how did prosecutors characterize all this at the trial?
Well, Assistant U.S. Attorney Joe Thompson called it a brazen and corrupt scheme that took advantage of a global pandemic and tarnished Minnesota's reputation for good governance.
It has become the shame of Minnesota. Hopefully, today's verdict will help turn the page on this awful chapter in our state's history.
After a five-week trial, the jury took only about 5 hours to reach its verdict. Bach's attorney, Ken Udoybach, says jurors likely made up their minds early on, and he's pledging to appeal.
What evidence did jurors hear?
FBI agents and forensic accountants recovered many six- and seven-figure checks, all of them signed by Amy Bach, and jurors saw stacks of them. From the start, prosecutors said that Bach organized Feeding Our Future to facilitate fraud and even created a phony board of directors. Ben Stayberg, a St. Paul bartender listed as board president, testified that Bach handed him what he thought was a petition about feeding children. He signed it, and then it was only years later, after the investigation became public and he saw his name in the New York Times, that Stayberg realized he was board president. The jury also heard testimony from six defendants who pleaded guilty and cooperated in the hopes of receiving lenient sentences.
All right, so what happens now in this case?
It'll be a few months before Bach and Saeed are sentenced, and Judge Nancy Brazel ordered them jailed until then. Several more defendants are scheduled to face trial in April. So far, more than half of the 70 defendants charged have pleaded guilty. Five others were convicted at a previous trial, and one received a sentence of 17 and a half years.
All right, that's Matt Sepik with Minnesota Public Radio. Matt, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. The Trump administration is accusing colleges across the U.S. of failing to address rising anti-Semitism on campus. But critics say the administration is conflating all criticism of Israel and Zionism, the movement for Jewish statehood in Israel, with anti-Semitism. Kenneth Stern told me that's reductive and unhelpful. Stern leads the Bard Center for the Study of Hate, and he drafted a widely adopted definition of anti-Semitism.
There's a big debate in the Jewish community. Most Jews are Zionists. I'm a Zionist. There's a growing number of younger Jews whose Judaism leads them to an anti-Zionist position. I may debate with them about the practical political implications of going down that road, but I'm not going to call them anti-Semites.
Stern says there's no question that anti-Jewish hate is on the rise in the U.S. since the October 7th attack on Israel. But he worries the Trump administration is using that pretext to silence speech it doesn't like. Now, the Trump administration has repeatedly said it is going to root out anti-Semitism specifically on college campuses, canceling $400 million in federal funding to Columbia, telling 60 colleges they're under investigation for failing to protect Jewish students. What do you make of that claim and the actions?
I think it's a total assault on the university, which has been a very important institution, you know, for Jews over the last number of decades. J.D. Vance had talked about sort of following the playbook of Orban in Hungary of dealing with education. And I think that's what we're seeing unfolding. We're seeing an attempt to not do things like say, okay, we're going to make a distinction between actual harassments, true threats, and so forth. We're going to go after views of people and hurt the university that way. I mean, the case with Mahmoud Khalil,
he's the green card holder who was a protest leader at Columbia and detained.
That's right. What they basically said is he was handing out pro-Hamas propaganda. Well, excuse me. I mean, I don't like pro-Hamas propaganda, but that's speech. And when you start saying that we're going to go after people whose speech we don't like for nothing more, that's the predicate. You know, where does that end? And to me, one of the things that's important for our ability to combat anti-Semitism and other forms of hate is having strong democratic institutions. When we're assaulting free speech, that's McCarthyism. We don't have strong democratic institutions anymore.
So are you saying then that the administration is weaponizing anti-Semitism?
Yes. Yes, it's absolutely weaponizing anti-Semitism. It's not to say that there isn't anti-Semitism on campuses. There have been horrible situations, you know, but look at what they're not doing and what they're doing. Look back to the Biden administration. It had a very detailed, comprehensive national strategy for combating anti-Semitism that had, you know, buy-in across the Jewish world. That's no longer the case.
And like you point out, there is real anti-Semitism and a rise in anti-Semitism. But does this approach make students any safer?
No, it makes them less safe. And what it does is it puts pro-Israel Jewish students in a situation where they may be seen as trying to suppress speech rather than answer it. When I teach, and I teach about anti-Semitism, and I teach about Israel and Palestine, I want students to be able to say what they think. I want to create a space where they feel comfortable to be wrong and experiment with ideas. If we don't have that as the core of the American educational enterprise, we're going to suffer tremendously in the long run.
I mean, I think I was reading just this morning about Columbia professors warning students that are not U.S. citizens,
yes,
not to post about Ukraine or Gaza, to talk about anything because it's too dangerous and they can't protect them.
Exactly right. And, you know, I understand why the university is giving that advice, but it should frighten all of us if they have to give that advice.
That was Kenneth Stern. He's the director for the Bard Center for the Study of Hate and the lead drafter of the working definition of anti-Semitism. Kenneth, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
We reached out to the White House for comment. They said, quote, "The only people weaponizing anti-Semitism are the liberal activists pushing Hamas propaganda on colleges and across our nation," unquote. Student protest groups have repeatedly said they are not affiliated with Hamas.
When floods hit North Carolina last fall, a lot of people lost necessities. Musicians also lost their instruments. Karen Czar with member station WUKY reports on a national effort to help.
On a recent Sunday, about 1,000 people line up outside the Arts Center at Warren Wilson College near Asheville. They hope to get donated instruments. John Rogers is a member of the Water Peppers band. They had more than $50,000 worth of instruments and equipment stored in their garage. The flood took it all.
10, 15 years worth of collection, stuff that you drive 500 miles for and fix it up and put a lot of time into. It's gone in 30 seconds.
He's in line hoping to replace some of it. Inside the building, 1,600 instruments have been tuned, repaired, and polished. Organizer Michael Jonathan said they were all donated by listeners to his Woodsongs Old Time radio show.
Just for Helene alone here in Western North Carolina and Eastern Tennessee, 36 drop-off points from Texas to Beacon, New York, Roanoke, Virginia, Cincinnati, across Kentucky.
Dozens of volunteers helped distribute the instruments. Meg Novak teaches music to elementary and middle school students in Asheville. Some of her students lost family members. Others climbed on rooftops and had to be rescued. She wanted to get violins for them and was handed a dozen child-sized instruments.
Yeah. I'm just so grateful. I'm gonna cry.
She said some students had been begging to learn how to play.
We think that kids have the resiliency and the bounce back, you know, I scuffed my knee, I'm going to bounce right back up and continue playing soccer, but these are a little bit different scars that they're carrying with them.
5-year-old Ava Thomas Chandler had to move schools after the flood. She's here because...
I am looking for a guitar.
Michael Jonathan pulls out a box.
Tell me if you like this.
Yes, I like it.
Do you like that?
That's amazing.
Is that a beautiful
yes,
guitar?
Yes, I like it.
When musician John Rogers gets his turn, he picks up an acoustic guitar, a dulcimer, and a couple of other instruments. Then he sits down in the grass and plays.
This is my literal therapy. This is without this is a little, it's a little tough without it. So this is really nice to get it back.
In less than an hour, all the instruments were spoken for and on their way to make music in their new homes. For NPR News, I'm Karen Czar in Asheville, North Carolina.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel.